loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, Israelis and Palestinians traded fire along the border with Gaza as the two sides engaged in ceasefire talks. But even as the talks took place, Palestinians fired rockets into Israel, and the Israeli military responded by bombing 25 sites in Gaza. Next, the Treasury Department today levied new sanctions on six Iranian nationals and three Iran-based entities, including Ansar-e-Hezbollah, the Hanista Programming Group, and the notorious Evin Prison. We'll look at what this means in the broader context of U.S. sanctions on Iran. Then, Russian journalist Arkady Babchenko was reported killed in Ukraine yesterday, and investigators had been looking for his killer. But today, at a press conference about his death, Babchenko appeared, live. Investigators say they were looking for people who were threatening him by faking his death. And then the Canadian government announced yesterday that it would buy Kinder Morgan's Trans Mountain Pipeline for $3.5 billion, hoping to save a project that has met with strong political and environmental opposition. And finally, according to a new filing today, federal prosecutors are poised to receive more than 1 million files from the three cell phones of President Trump's personal attorney, Michael Cohen. Federal investigators already have access to more than 300,000 pages of documents seized from Cohen's office. The filing was made by a special master appointed to protect information subject to attorney-client privilege. But is that even possible in an investigation of this magnitude? That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear. But first, we turn to Palestine. Days after the most recent massacre of people in Gaza by Israeli snipers, Israelis and Palestinians traded fire along the border with Gaza as the two sides engaged in ceasefire talks. But even as the talks took place, the Israeli military bombed 25 sites in Gaza, which they claim was undertaken in self-defense. We're joined from Chicago by Ali Abunima, the co-founder of the Electronic Intifada and the author of the book, The Battle for Justice in Palestine. Welcome back, Ali.
Thank you very much.
Ali, tell us a little bit about this ceasefire. How is it being negotiated? Do you expect it to hold? And what's the end goal here for both sides?
Well, the ceasefire was something that the Palestinian faction sought, and they initiated military action yesterday against Israel, where they fired several dozen mortar shells and rockets across the line in what appears to have been a carefully calculated operation which injured three Israeli soldiers. And what has been missed in the mainstream media is that this military operation by the Palestinian resistance groups came after Israel shelled and killed at least four Palestinian fighters on Sunday in what was considered a major breach of the ceasefire understandings reached after Israel's last major attack on Gaza in 2014. And so after those killings on Sunday, Islamic Jihad, one of the two major military factions in Gaza, said it would retaliate. And it seems that Hamas also took part in that retaliation, where they fired these shells into Israel. And the goal all along was to send a message to Israel that, look, you cannot keep bombing Gaza without paying a price. And it seems Israel got the message, because the Israelis very quickly, after weeks of bombing Gaza, very quickly agreed to a ceasefire requested by Hamas. That's according to Haaretz, one of Israel's main newspapers, that Hamas sent a message to Israel through Egypt saying, if you abide by the ceasefire, we will also abide by the ceasefire, and Israel agreed. The other thing to recall is that this Palestinian military response came after weeks of Israel massacring Palestinians on a nearly daily basis, more than 100 Palestinians murdered by snipers, thousands more injured, many hundreds of them with permanent disabilities from exploding bullets, and of course Israel frequently bombing Gaza. And during this period, in fact since February, there has been no Palestinian missiles or rockets fired from Gaza. So Palestinians have shown utmost restraint in the face of relentless and constant Israeli aggression and killing, until finally Palestinian factions decided to send a very measured, military message to Israel on Tuesday, and it seems that Israel got the message. But since Israel has a very bad record of abiding by ceasefire agreements, we'll have to see if it holds.
And none of the core issues have been resolved. This is just a ceasefire. This isn't an ongoing political negotiation. So what are we looking at in the near and medium term?
Well, you're right. This simply, if it holds, prevents Israel from continuing to bomb Gaza willy-nilly. I'm not even sure that it covers the issue of Israel slaughtering unarmed protesters at will across the border. This seems to have to do with the military exchanges between Palestinian resistance groups on the one hand and Israeli occupation forces on the other. But the bigger issue of Gaza, which is what Palestinians have been protesting about, weeks and weeks of civil protests along the border, the boundary line, which Israel has responded to with murderous rampages. This is to end the siege of Gaza, 12 years of hermetic siege. Yesterday, on Tuesday, a Palestinian boat set out, I mean, in just little fishing boats, if you look at the pictures, in a symbolic attempt to break Israel's maritime blockade of Gaza, to carry some of the thousands of wounded people to Cyprus for treatment, which they can't get in Gaza because the hospitals are overwhelmed, and Israel allows people out of Gaza for treatment only with great difficulty. This was a symbolic attempt to break the siege with a medical flotilla, and of course Israel stopped it. So this is what siege means in practice. 2 million people in a ghetto, and they are killed if they try to get out or even to protest being caged in the ghetto. Someone had made the point, a writer made the point, I don't remember who it is off the top of my head, an important point, that Israel killed in the space of, 1 or 2 days this month or last month, as many people who had been killed trying to cross the Berlin Wall in 40 years, just to give a sense of the mindless and merciless brutality with which Israel treats the people of Gaza.
Goodness, historical reference point. I want to help the audience understand a little bit about the dynamic politically inside Gaza and among the different resistance forces. I mean, when you have this level of merciless shooting of unarmed demonstrators, and you have resistance organizations that have an armed capability, including Hamas or Islamic Jihad or the PFLP or the DFLP or any of the organizations that made up the Palestinian movement and the Palestinian nation, there must be a great sense of frustration, the inability to hit back. And yet this time they were able to hit back, and even a few Israeli casualties seem to have an impact on Israeli decision-making. What's the takeaway then for the resistance organizations inside of Gaza?
I think that they understand, the political factions, particularly Hamas, understand that their military option, which they do have, is primarily a deterrent and defensive option. They don't really have an offensive military option against Israel. I think their goal, and that's what the goal was with this limited strike that they carried out on Tuesday, was to remind Israel that attacking Gaza is not cost-free. And if you should continue your bombing or you should contemplate another invasion, we have the capability to make you pay a price which, you may consider unacceptable. So that's where they are. On the political level, Hamas set out a strategy, more than a year ago when it published effectively its new charter, really reiterating a message it's been sending for many years, which says, we're interested in politics, we're interested in engagement, we're open to the world, we want to follow the same path as, Sinn Féin and the IRA in Ireland. We just need a partner. We need someone who's willing to talk to us. Unfortunately, the so-called international community, which takes its cues from Israel on this, has slammed the door. The European Union has slammed the door. But nonetheless, they seem to understand from my observation, that they're engaged in a battle for international legitimacy, for international public opinion, which is why there is a strong consensus, not just Hamas, this is a strong consensus in Gaza, which Hamas, like other factions, would like to take credit for, I'm sure, but there's a strong consensus towards mass civil mobilization. That's what we've seen in the Great March of Return. Families, people, thousands of people taking part together. And of course, Israel's attempt is to falsely portray and smear all of this as a Hamas plot, and that everyone who takes part in these protests is a terrorist and deserves to be killed, essentially. But that's not what's going on in Gaza. What you have is 2 million people who are under a crushing siege, who are under unprecedented conditions in modern times. There's no other example of this in the world in recent history, of 2 million people being subjected to this prolonged siege, and the so-called international community simply tolerating it or even aiding and abetting Israel. And the people of Gaza trying to break it. They're trying to break it with all their means. And by taking part in these protests, they're trying to send a message to the rest of the world saying, we refuse to be forgotten. We refuse to die silently. And we need the rest of the world to speak up and put pressure on Israel to end this horror that we're living through. That's what's going on. It's not very complicated.
It's not complicated. It's amazing that we have this unprecedented siege and this unprecedented resilience from a people who have suffered so much and just won't stop. I mean, Palestine exists because of the consciousness of the people. It's an amazing thing. I certainly hope Ali is right, and that what we're going to witness now is an opening up. The whole world needs to open up and show support right now, not tomorrow, not next week, but right now, for Palestine.
We're out of time, unfortunately. We're joined from Chicago by Ali Abu Nima, the co-founder of the Electronic Intifada and author of the book, The Battle for Justice in Palestine. Listening to Loud and Clear, stay tuned. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
The Treasury Department today levied new sanctions on 6 Iranian nationals and 3 Iran-based entities, including Ansar Hezbollah, the Hanista Programming Group, and Evin Prison. We'll look at what this means in the broader context of U.S. sanctions on Iran. We're joined from Colombia by Dan Kovalik, a human rights and labor lawyer who is the author of The Plot to Attack Iran. And we're joined from Tehran by Mohammed Mirandi, an expert on American studies and post-colonial literature who teaches at the University of Tehran. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Mohammed, let's start with you. These sanctions didn't get much coverage in the U.S. today, and they seem to be just very tangential, I guess I can say, to the larger sanctions regime. Why target 6 Iranian nationals and 3 Iran-based entities?
I think it's probably more for psychological purposes. I mean, the Ansar Hezbollah is a small political party with a newspaper, I think. And I don't even know how they're relevant. As things are moving forward, I assume my wife and children will be sanctioned at some point. And the list will ultimately include almost everyone in the country. It really doesn't make any sense unless one looks at it as some sort of a small piece in this broader puzzle of psychological warfare. It doesn't do anything to the Iranian economy, at least those entities that I've seen, and it doesn't have any impact unless they just want to, you know, remind Iranians that they're being sanctioned and pressured.
There was an article in today's Wall Street Journal quoting the CEO of Maersk Lines and its parent company, A.P. Moller Maersk. It's the largest shipping company in the world, of course. And he says that, here's the quote. He says, "I don't think any shipping line that operates globally will be able to do business in Iran if the sanctions arrive in full force the way they are intended." So even if other countries in Europe, let's say, or Asia, don't follow U.S. sanctions, do you still expect a bite? Is it still going to hurt just because shipping companies like Maersk are not going to be able to deliver goods to Iran or to ship them out?
Well, the objective is obviously to make ordinary Iranians suffer. That, and that was what Obama was trying to do as well. The crippling sanctions that Obama implemented were to prevent Iran from importing food and medicine. And they did succeed in for a period of time until the Iranians began to learn how to circumvent the sanctions. And I think probably thousands of cancer patients and others who needed medicine immediately, imported medicine, they died during those months thanks to Obama. And I think the objective obviously now is the same. The United States wants to create misery throughout the country. I'm sure many Americans support this, but I'm sure that overwhelmingly ordinary Americans, humane Americans, would be outraged. But the objective is, this is like war without bombs. They want to destroy the economy, destroy lives, and create universal misery in the country. But I don't think they're going to, while I do think it's going to be, the next few months will be difficult, I don't think they're going to succeed because the world has changed. The Chinese, I don't think that they are going to abide by U.S. demands. I don't think the Russians are going to either. And other growing economies like India, they have their own interests. I think the United States overestimates their influence. And the fact that the United States is trying to bully other countries into abiding by its dictates, it is in the long run only going to weaken its own global reach and its ability to influence other countries. So it will, I think there will be hurt in Iran, but ultimately I think the Iranians will circumvent the U.S. sanctions. And ironically, what will happen is that U.S. rivals will benefit because countries, as I said, like China and Russia and most probably India, these are the countries that will benefit the most.
Brian, the Indian government made a statement this morning, or released a statement this morning, saying that they observe United Nations sanctions as a part of international law, that they do not observe U.S. sanctions, which are unilateral. Do you think that's a trend?
Well, I hope so. I mean, this was the problem back in the day for Iraq during the 1990s when the U.S. was able to impose sanctions on Iraq, but it came through vis-a-vis the U.N. Security Council. So it had the weight of international law. And Iraq was really, truly shut down. Even its neighbors, Syria, Jordan, they weren't trading with Iraq. And as a consequence, the living standards of the people collapsed. I went to Iraq multiple times during that time period. Literally, when you went through the hospitals, babies were dying from completely treatable diseases and ailments like bloody diarrhea or, you know, just other easily treatable things. And all the countries of the world observed it because it was the UN. If India says no to the sanctions, if China says on Iran, if China says no, if Russia says no, if these corporate entities or state-backed entities say no to the sanctions, then it's not going to be like it was for Iraq in the 1990s. And again, that was, just as Mohamed Mirandi said, a war but without bombs, and perhaps more destructive than a war with bombs. We had at the UN's own estimates were that 8,000 Iraqis, mostly children under the age of five, were dying every month from sanctions. Those were the UN, the agencies in charge of enforcing the sanctions. Those were their statistics. Dan Kovalik, we're joined now by Dan Kovalik. He's a human rights and labor lawyer. He's the author of The Plot to Attack Iran. Dan Kovalik, thanks for joining us. We're talking with Mohamed Mirandi, also from Tehran, about these new sanctions. Mohamed's making the point that in some ways the new sanctions are, if anything, a kind of a psychological warfare to remind the Iranian people that the U.S. has them in an economic vice, but Mohamed doesn't feel they're going to actually succeed. What's your take on all of this?
I hope that's true. I hope they don't succeed because, as you mentioned, Brian, it will just cause suffering for average Iranian people, which the sanctions up till now has done. You know, the sanctions have cost the Iranian economy billions of dollars, and social programs that were promised by President Rouhani have not been able to be implemented because they don't have the revenue. So I hope that they don't succeed. And as you say, they very well might not, because the rest of the world seems not willing to go along with this. They know that Iran has been complying with the nuclear deal. Even Europe didn't want, even the more kind of conservative elements of Europe didn't want Trump to back out of the deal. So I hope that, in fact, this does not work and does not hurt the Iranian people. I mean, there's a certain way, and I've been saying this for a while, in which the U.S. is sanctioning so many countries, it's going to sanction itself out of the international markets. You know, countries are just going to stop using the dollar because they're tired of being, you know, blackmailed by the United States, and the U.S. may end up losing itself by all of this.
Mohamed Mirandi, what's the mood in Iran?
Well, people are not happy with what's going on, and as I said earlier, I think that it's clear that the sanctions will bite. I don't think they will succeed in the sense that I don't think that the United States will be able to force Iran to give up its sovereignty. The United States, Trump is one of the things that he's done is that he's united the country more than ever before, at least since the last 20, 25 years. I've never seen the country united over a single issue so much. Yes, people are not happy. They are concerned about their children and about medicine and about other things. But again, there are the world has changed a lot. Iran is much, much larger than Iraq. It has many regional allies. As I said, the country is quite united, thanks to Trump, more than anyone else. And as you rightly pointed out, these are not UN sanctions. Of course, the UN sanctions on Iraq were quite inhumane. But regardless of that, these are not UN sanctions. Trump has isolated the United States, as your guest rightly pointed out. He's in confrontation with all sorts of countries over tariffs and sanctions and so on. And he's, you know, creating an incentive for countries to move away from the U.S. dollar and the financial institutions that the United States can weaponize. So, and very important, powerful countries that are much more powerful than they were 5, 10, 15 years ago and more relevant to Iran's economy, like China, like India, like Russia, they are more than willing to continue cooperating with Iran. And I think in the case of China, there is a strong incentive to deepen ties with Iran, especially since China right now is engaging on the receiving end of Trump's threats for punitive tariffs.
Let's bring Dan Kovalik in. Dan, we're really out of time. We have 45 seconds left. What will Europe do? Again, it sounds like the French and British and German companies may, in fact, fearing sanctions, stop their business dealings with Iran. What do you think about that?
Well, that is always the problem, that even if, you know, Europe doesn't want to honor the sanctions, companies are going to be afraid of the backlash. And so they may just as a preemptive move, leave Iran or stop business with Iran. And that's always the problem. And that's happened in Venezuela as well, where companies, even if they're not prohibited by sanctions from dealing with the country, they shy away from it. And again, it ends up being devastating for that country, in this case, Iran. And of course, the big question is, are these sanctions, you know, a precursor to some sort of military intervention, which again would be disastrous for millions of people.
That was the voice of Dan Kovalik. He's a human rights and labor lawyer who's the author of The Plot to Attack Iran. And we were joined from Tehran by Mohamed Mirandi, an expert on American studies and postcolonial literature who teaches at the University of Tehran. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll take a short break and come right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Russian journalist Arkady Babchenko was reported killed in Ukraine yesterday, and investigators had been looking for his killer. But today at a press conference about his death, Babchenko showed up, alive. Investigators say they were looking for people who were threatening him by faking his death. We're joined from Moscow by Mark Sloboda. He's an international affairs and security analyst. Mark, good to have you.
Hey, thanks for having me on. It's always an honor and a pleasure to be on Loud and Clear.
Well, thank you. So this turned out to be kind of a fancy law enforcement operation, not some kind of foul-up. Why would authorities fake Babchenko's death? And who would want to kill him anyway?
Yeah, that's not exactly clear. That is the story that we are hearing now. The Ukrainian regime's intelligence service, along with the police, said that this hoax was a deliberate sting to try to lure his killers, which they still say have Russia connections. They say there was a plot to kill him out into the open. Supposedly, they've arrested one person they say that's involved, who is a Ukrainian citizen. But they haven't provided any evidence, any details, any explanation of how this elaborate hoax would allow them to expose those who supposedly were plotting his death, and no explanation of why, in the hours running up to this, not only did they fake his death, but they went so far as the Ukrainian Prime Minister, Vasily Groysman, actually blamed Russia for it, along with the entirety of the Western press corps.
I'm looking at the Reuters article from yesterday. A prominent Russian journalist and critic of Russian President Vladimir Putin was shot dead in Ukraine, where he had fled into exile following threats, police said on Tuesday. Arkady Babchenko, 41, died of wounds in an ambulance after his wife found him covered in his blood in their home, police said, adding they suspected the murder was due to Babchenko's professional activities. Babchenko, a former soldier in the Chechen War, who had become one of Russia's best-known war correspondents, had left his homeland fearing for his life after criticizing Russian policy in Ukraine and Syria. Mark Sloboda, just who is Arkady Babchenko, and I mean, why is this happening?
Yeah, Arkady Babchenko is a rather colorful character. He did serve in the First Chechen War, where he avoided combat by first trying to claim mental illness, going so far as to bribe a doctor to certify this, and then failed. And then evidently his parents showed up and threatened to handcuff themselves to him and to the radiator in the room if they dragged him back. But it gets better. So he didn't go off in the combat in the First Chechen War. The Second Chechen War, when Chechen forces invaded, Dagestan started, he volunteered to go back as a contract soldier, as a paid soldier, to go back and fight in Chechnya. Then afterwards, after serving briefly there, he suddenly became an anti-war activist, or at least an anti-Russian government activist, and this coincided with his being a journalist, because these anti-government activists and journalists are at least the same thing, at least as far as Western press corps is concerned. And he has been much lionized. He wrote a book about his experiences in Chechnya, which is a very interesting read and certainly has some interesting points, but it's been much criticized by many other veterans of these conflicts, saying that his accuracy and exaggerations leave a lot to be desired. But there was he has been very critical of the Russian government, its operations in Ukraine, in Syria. He supported the Maidan putsch in Ukraine and actively said that he wanted to repeat that in Russia. And then when Russia got involved in an intervention to prevent the overthrow of the Syrian government, a Russian plane crashed with the Red Army Choir, a number of members of the Red Army Choir, and some journalists on board. And he said this didn't bother him at all. He wasn't saddened. He thought they were all guilty and that they deserved to die. This did not make him a big the Russian public was not a big fan of him after these statements. He fled into Ukraine, into self-exile, saying he feared for his life, and started carrying on in Ukraine. But his reporting was also critical of the new regime in Ukraine, and he had also received many threats there. But, of course, as soon as the news came out that supposedly he was murdered, they never quite got the story right. They weren't sure how many shots. It was either happened outside his house or on his way somewhere. He was shot in the front. He was shot in the back. He died at home. He died on the way to the hospital. Nothing was clear. And within 24 hours, it has now emerged that he popped out in the press conference, and the whole thing was a hoax. So this has really earned him no love from Western journalists, who all feel quite betrayed.
He's let them down by being alive.
Yeah, well, they were all busy tweeting and blaming Russia, and talking for the last 24 hours, writing obituaries. There were flowers laid, pictures. It was quite a spectacle. Miriam Elder at Foreign Policy, she's at BuzzFeed now, said it was a collective trauma over his death. This is all rather strange that when they were all bringing up this, none of them happened to mention that there have been 11 journalists and media workers who have died in the Ukraine in the last 3 years since the Maidan putsch overthrew the government there, and all of them have been critical of the Ukrainian government, and none of those have ever been solved. Some of them have been written off as crossfire in conflict, hit by Ukrainian artillery shells and so on. Others were clear and outright murder. None of them have been solved. But there was no criticality. There was no questioning of the reports coming from the Ukrainian government about this situation when it occurred. There was no fact-checking. It was pure stenography. They've got busted, and they have collective eggs across their faces. They're upset. Their biggest worry is now is not about the hoax or what it says about their own reporting or the whole Russophobic narrative, but the gift that this gives to Russian media. That is what they're most worried about. That now that calls into question everything else.
Why is this so much more newsworthy than any other death of any other journalist in Ukraine? As you said, this terrible thing happens all the time. So why did people yesterday care so much more about this than anybody else?
Yeah, there have only been two journalists' deaths in Ukraine that have received any attention from the Western media. One of them was obviously fake, Babchenko. The other one was Paul Sheremets, because he was a liberal. He was a pro-Western liberal. Now, unfortunately, they also suspect that he was killed by Ukrainian nationalists because of his criticality towards how the new regime has shaped out, complaining about its corruption, it wasn't what they wanted, and so on. He was on a hit list by the Mirotvorets website, supported by the Ukrainian intelligence service and propped by their new interior minister. That goes so far as to list 4,508 journalists around the world who are enemies of Ukraine and list their addresses so that they can be identified. Already one journalist and one former lawmaker have been assassinated. It's very likely, Paul Sheremets is likely one of these victims.
Mark Sloboda is our guest. He's an international affairs and security analyst. We're talking to him from Moscow about the Russian journalist who was brutally killed by agents of the Putin government, we were told. Until he showed up today at a press conference where it became clear that along with Ukrainian and U.S.-backed Ukrainian intelligence services, he faked his own death. The Western media, Reuters, Washington Post, they were all over the story. Here's the Washington Post about the fact that Babchenko is indeed alive. Russia's foreign ministry expressed relief at Babchenko being alive. This is the Washington Post. Yes, because yesterday, we were certain, according to the Washington Post, that the Russian government had killed Babchenko, But now they sort of glibly say, well, the Russian foreign ministry is relieved that he's alive because obviously the lie about his death can quite obviously be proved since he's there in the flesh. 1 minute left, Mark.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if there's a greater example of fake news than all of this. Personally, I suspect that Putin probably really arranged it to call into credibility the Western press's reporting. And he probably sent the same person to kill Babchenko that he sent to kill the Skripals, rather incompetent, intelligence agent, being as that they are all still alive. It seems not only the Skripals have returned from the dead, but so has Arkady Babchenko. George Galloway, the former British MP and media personality, came out and said, you couldn't believe that they made it up. Except that they did.
We'll leave it there. We were joined from Moscow by Mark Sloboda. Mark is an international affairs and security analyst. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll take a short break and come right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou in studio with my co-host Brian Becker. The Canadian government announced yesterday that it would buy Kinder Morgan's Trans Mountain Pipeline for $3.5 billion, hoping to save a project that has met with strong political and environmental opposition. We're joined from Vancouver, Canada by Alison Bodine. She's a member of the Fire This Time movement for social justice and of Climate Convergence Metro Vancouver. Alison, welcome to the show.
Thank you, John.
Alison, Canada's got a very progressive government by all accounts. Why would they do something like this, knowing that there is such widespread and broad political environmental opposition to this pipeline?
So the Kinder Morgan pipeline project is actually an expansion of an existing pipeline. And essentially, the Liberal government of Canada has agreed to buy the pipeline that's existing and 65 years old to the tune of actually $4.5 billion, and then to indemnify and fund the construction on some kind of unspecified terms of an expansion project, which, as you said, is widely opposed here in British Columbia and across Canada by all sectors of society, from Indigenous nations through which the pipeline goes through their traditional territories, through unions and just everyday people here, especially in British Columbia. Now, the Liberal government has this kind of mask on in a lot of ways internationally that we see torn down in many different ways all the time, whether it's their support for the bombing of Syria in April, or their condemnation of the democratically elected government of Venezuela, or in this case, this purchasing of a dirty tar sands pipeline. So a lot of us in the environmental justice movement and the social justice movement are not altogether surprised that they would go to this extent to get this pipeline built. It's kind of like the last vestiges of a dying industry that they're trying to prop up and really have given themselves the illusion that this would help the economy of Canada, when all it does is line the pockets of the richest of the world, and in this case, of the Kinder Morgan Corporation, which is based in the United States.
I should have specified in my intro that that it's 4.5 billion Canadian dollars, 3.46 American dollars. You were right, 4.5 billion Canadian. I want to make a couple of points and ask you to comment on them. There's a Reuters report that came out today saying that the federal government in Canada decided to do this in order to get around, legally, to get around opposition from the government of British Columbia, because now the pipeline extension would be under federal jurisdiction. How does that work?
So the pipeline was already federally approved. This happened under the Liberal government of Justin Trudeau in 2016. There's a lot of interesting stories about all the backdoor deals that were made to get that approval. But actually, the purchasing of the pipeline by the federal government does not get around these court cases. There are legal challenges, 14 of them, by Indigenous nations here in British Columbia, as well as the one you've referred to by the government of British Columbia against the pipeline. And although some legal experts are saying that the government may have some sort of immunity when it comes to these cases. Those legal challenges still have to be heard, and we've yet to see any real argument that this would stop anything. Even the the Natural Resource Minister of Canada, Jim Carr, stated when they made this announcement of the purchase that the project is facing unprecedented headwinds. So they still recognize that this opposition is not going away, whether it's in the form of court challenges, which, like I said, it's yet to be seen that any sort of immunity would do them any good, or it's the grassroots mobilizing that is happening daily here in British Columbia.
That's the voice of Alison Bodine. She's a member of Fire This Time Movement for Social Justice and of Climate Convergence Metro Vancouver. We're talking to Alison about the Canadian government's decision announced yesterday that it would buy Kinder Morgan's Trans Mountain Pipeline for $3.5 billion American dollars, hoping to save a project that's met strong political opposition. Alison, this is requiring Justin Trudeau to expend a little bit of political capital in addition to the capital from that comes from the Canadian Treasury. What's the likely impact in terms of his own standing among Canadians and in the different places in the political spectrum?
Oh, I think it's very clear that he will have lost political support as far as the Liberal government is concerned, especially here in British Columbia. But there's also been protests across Canada, including in Quebec and across Ontario that have been in solidarity with the resistance here in British Columbia. So we'd like not to keep it so much that they're saying that BC is the whole problem. It's really that people see through this pipeline purchase. They realize that Canada and the Liberal government of Trudeau has admitted that they won't be able to meet their targets for emissions that were made internationally. They've said in 2020 they're not going to meet them, and in 2030 there's little chance that they'll meet them unless drastic changes are made. And now they've purchased a dirty tar sands pipeline. So I think people are beginning to see through that, and it's a very real threat to their ability to maintain government in Canada. And for us, though, I'd like to see it as an opportunity to build a stronger climate justice movement and to really expose the government for what it is. They say they're climate leaders internationally, but Canada's economy is investing more and more in resource extraction and not in renewable energy. So they're no sort of international example when it comes to climate justice by any stretch of the word.
It's very interesting. I mean, the company is based in Houston. And then you have
the
Trudeau government arguing that this is all about jobs. And yet the government, the provincial government of British Columbia says, well, launched a legal challenge against it. Alison, when you're actually trying to think through, given the fact that Justin Trudeau is going to lose political support to bail out, to save a pipeline from a Houston-based company, what's his thinking? What's actually the calculation?
I think it's really based on this idea that they sell internationally, that Canada is open for business when it comes to resource extraction. I think they're quite afraid that if this pipeline does not get built, then their other resource extraction projects will also not be successful, because investors will basically be afraid from investing in Canada. And instead of choosing to invest in renewable energy or in other jobs, they are instead still banking on this resource extraction project. If you really look at the amount that Canada's economy has been supported by mining, by forestry, by oil extraction or LNG, you see how closely tied the government really is to these international energy corporations. And so although, like you said, Kinder Morgan is, you know, based in Texas, it's not that closely tied to the government of Canada, I think it'd send a so-called bad signal to the international market. But as climate justice activists, I mean, we don't accept any of those arguments. We need Canada to shift its economy away from this resource extraction. And I think the government is still just so deep in with these international corporations that they can't really get out.
I want to ask you about the oil itself too. This is all part of an even bigger project. It's a $7.4 billion expansion that's supposed to triple the amount of Western Canadian crude that is shipped from Alberta to the Pacific coast, and then it goes on to Asian countries from there. But this is tar sands oil. It's very, very dirty, and it's actually dangerous to transport from point A to point B. Tell us about that.
It certainly is. So this pipeline's 1,100 kilometers, and it will transport something called dilbit, which is diluted bitumen. Bitumen is very thick, very heavy, and impossible to clean up, and they dilute it with a bunch of other dangerous chemicals in order to make it possible to even flow through a pipeline. This is the same oil that leaked out of another Enbridge pipeline in Kalamazoo, Michigan, a few years ago, and cost billions of dollars to clean up or to even get the river to reopen. It's extremely dangerous product. It's there's no clear cleanup plan for what would happen if it spilt, and it actually, like you said, triples the amount of bitumen traveling through the province, but also makes the number of tankers that are right here off the coast of Vancouver, a heavily populated area, an area that relies a lot on the health of the ocean for tourism and fisheries. It makes those number of tankers go up sevenfold, up to 34 tankers a month by some estimates. And like I said, there's no plan to clean it up. And interestingly enough, the tanks that hold this diluted bitumen are located in the city of Burnaby, a heavily populated city, and the fire marshal of the city of Burnaby has said that they have no means to protect the people that will be affected by this pipeline traveling through their neighborhoods or by the tank farm if any sort of leak or explosion happens. There is no plan in order to safely evacuate them or to prevent really a disaster happening in such a municipal area.
All right. Allison, in the last 10 seconds, how can people find out about what you're doing and what your movement is doing?
So like I said, the grassroots movement is really strong, continuing in British Columbia. This pipeline will not be built. And for more information, people can go to climateconvergence.ca. That's climateconvergence.ca.
Climateconvergence.ca. Okay, thank you. We were joined from Vancouver, Canada by Allison Bodine. She's a member of the Fire This Time Movement for Social Justice and of Climate Convergence Metro Vancouver. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
According to a new filing today, federal prosecutors are poised to receive more than 1 million files from the three cell phones of President Trump's personal attorney, Michael Cohen. Federal investigators already have access to more than 300,000 pages of documents seized from Cohen's office. The filing was made by a special master appointed to protect information subject to attorney-client privilege. But is that even possible in an investigation of this magnitude? We're joined from New York by Daniel Lazar. He's a journalist and author of The Frozen Republic, The Velvet Coup, and America's Undeclared War. Daniel, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Daniel, is it possible to protect attorney-client privilege when you're turning over, so far, 1.3 million pages of documents?
It seems more and more difficult, doesn't it? I mean, this whole dragnet seems to be just trampling any kind of concept of attorney-client privilege. But they're going after Cohen in a big way, so I guess they really want to get him.
Well, explain to us this idea of a special master. What's the special master actually do?
The special master is supposed to call through the material to find out what is actually covered by attorney-client privilege, as I understand it. So there is supposedly some kind of protection there that the courts have built in. But the volume is so huge, the dragnet is so complete, that I don't quite see how this can work out.
So you have the FBI going in and seizing all of the files of Michael Cohen, Donald Trump's attorney. Of course, let's just, for our audience, remind them we are not fans in any shape or form of Donald Trump or Michael Cohen. But what we have here is the federal government, the FBI, going in and seizing the files of the personal lawyer of Donald Trump. And they seized everything, including his computers and files and phones, at his hotel, at his apartment, at his office, even though Cohen was cooperating with the special prosecutor. So the special prosecutor now has like everything that Donald Trump and Michael Cohen communicated about, as well as the communications between many, many, many other people who happen to have employed Michael Cohen as their attorney. So now the government has this vast quantity of information. Now, not all communications between an attorney and a client are necessarily privileged, but a lot of it is. And Daniel Azar, it's considered to be, in many ways, the foundation of a democratic or purportedly democratic legal system, because if you can't talk to your lawyer in private with confidence and with confidentiality, if those communications can be grabbed by the people who are prosecuting you or may want to prosecute you, then the deck is completely stacked in the for the government against the individual. And it would seem to me that while this is not the first time lawyer client confidentiality is at stake, doing this to the president's personal lawyer sets an amazing precedent in terms of giving the government an amazing power, an amazing reach. If they can do this, say, to the president's lawyer and gather all that previously, the communication that both sides thought was confidential, well, certainly you would think they could do it to anybody.
I certainly agree. I mean, as you said before, we're not pro-Trump, but we are pro-civil liberties, or at least I am. And these protections are vitally important, and therefore it's very dangerous that they're being trampled. Whether the people trampling them are pro or anti-Trump or pro or anti-Clinton or whatever. And so, yeah, so this is really worrisome. But so much has been trampled in the feverish, in the political fevers of the last 2 years. I mean, the NSA has released confidential intercepts in order to trap Mike Flynn, for example. You know, practices that supposedly went out with the Church Commission, the Church Committee back in the 1970s have been revived, and civil liberties are taking a huge beating. But of course, liberals. Or groups like the ACLU don't want to acknowledge that because they're so seized by their anti-Trump passion.
You know, that's really a very important point. I consider myself to be a civil libertarian, too. I'm certainly not a conservative. I consider myself to be very progressive. But Dan's he's right. It's as though self-described progressives have turned their backs on civil liberties just in their because of their dislike of Donald Trump. And they're walking away from their values.
And John, there's even a better example closer to home, and that is RT, which has been forced to register as a foreign lobby, you know, in flagrant violation of any kind of freedom of the press or civil liberties. And of course, none of the civil liberties groups, the ACLU or whatever, have spoken out against this. They are so blinded by their anti-Trump passion that they are opening the door to practices that they inveighed against for decades. It's an amazing spectacle.
Daniel Azar is our guest. Daniel is a journalist and the author of The Frozen Republic, The Velvet Coup, and America's Undeclared War. You're listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker, joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. Daniel, our station, Sputnik, has also been forced to register as a foreign agent. I mean, it's so ludicrous. Our show, this show, has been on since the beginning of the 2016 campaign. No one who heard our show could possibly say that we were anything but a vigorous critics of Donald Trump during the entire campaign. That was also true about By Any Means Necessary, the show with Eugene Perrier during that time period. There was another show here. All of these shows were anti-Trump. And yet here we are, Sputnik forced to register as a foreign agent. So every time somebody hears our show, every hour it says, you know, you can find out more information about our show with the Department of Justice, sending a chilling message about alternative media and you know, just basic the freedom of the press. Here also with this case with Michael Cohen, there's some reports that have alluded to stuff that came out around 1975 with the Church Committee, the thing that you mentioned. There's some allusion to it in the Washington Post and the New York Times, but none of these media outlets actually say what the church committees were. And as if it was this period of American history that just has vanished. Again, tell the audience what the church committee was, why it came into existence, and why it's important.
Well, the Church Committee came into existence in the aftermath of Watergate, which also saw major revelations, exposés by papers like the Washington Post, New York Times, of CIA and FBI spying and various kinds of bad behavior. And the Church Commission was supposed to remove this threat, to make the CIA pledge never to spy on American citizens again. But we've seen that the NSA has actually used surreptitious intercepts to zap members of the Trump administration like Mike Flynn. And once again, let me stress, Mike Flynn is a right-wing idiot who is just a complete fool, but nonetheless he should not be spied upon by the intelligence agencies, because if he's spied upon, then you and I and everyone listening to this program will be spied on next. This is a very basic principle, which is very important, however.
Yeah, and you had Mueller, who was the former head of the FBI, we used to all protest Mueller because they were rounding up Muslims and people from the Middle East and South Asia just because they were Muslims after September 11th. You have James Comey, who created the black identity extremist label to be able to justify the FBI spying under his watch of the Black Lives Matter movement. The worst features, really, of the FBI sort of misconduct and abuse that was exposed by the Church Committee and the reforms that came thereafter. And now we have all of these liberals who used to protest against the FBI saying, James Comey and Robert Mueller, they're keeping America safe, saving our democracy from the Russian bear. Again, I think people are so short-sighted. Again, you can hate Michael Cohen and Donald Trump, but if you believe the FBI should raid attorneys' offices and seize all of those files and then be the determinant power to determine which is appropriate and which is not, you're just saying to the FBI, to the secret police, go ahead, carry out a witch hunt against whomever, and guess what? That'll be good for our democracy. I mean, it's that ludicrous.
Robert Mueller was on the cover of the Nation magazine recently, and not in a bad way, unfortunately. So the Nation, all these liberal publications have just swallowed their scruples, their principles, in endorsing a guy who was a major part of the abuses launched by the Bush administration when he was head of the FBI. It's just it's crazy, crazy stuff. And people have lost sight of what's really important.
We will leave it there. We were joined from New York by Daniel Lazar. Daniel's a journalist and author of The Frozen Republic, The Velvet Coup, and America's Undeclared War. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. We are out of time. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. And you can follow us on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can also hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can also hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes and at iHeartRadio. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We'll see you next time.
Loud and Clear.